Hello, everybody. Thank you for showing up and being part of this webinar. Welcome. And today on the panel, we have myself, some of you already know me, and we have Jocelyn Traub, who's joining us. And of course, we have our wonderful Brett and Joe in the background helping us out. So I think I'd like to start, even though I didn't notice that Ray was there. Is Ray there? I don't think so yet. And he has a question here that he wanted to be addressed. I'll start it anyway, and maybe even if he doesn't join us, he can always get this in the recording. So here is his first question. In the United Kingdom, especially, the organized religions are seeing a drop in attendance in church, and there is a lessening of interest in Christianity. Do you think that this is related to the passing out of Ray 6 and that an interest in mystic spirituality is related to the incoming of Ray 7? Also, in what other ways do you think we will see changes in everyday life regarding the incoming Ray 7? This is an excellent question because we are moving slowly still out of the Piscean Age, which is the sixth ray, and we're moving into the Aquarian Age, which will also bring in the seventh ray. Not through Aquarius, but through its very strong ruling planet, which is Uranus. As also, the second thing with the seventh ray is that the cycle, you know, everything is cyclical. The cycle of the seventh ray is now coming in. Just like we're told that fourth ray souls are not right now, that there are not that many of them because the fourth ray is not really, hasn't cycled in, and we're not really part of that fourth ray energy. And yet, you know, fourth ray governs the human kingdom. The seventh ray is now cycling in, and it's going to be around for quite some time. So we have it coming in two ways. Now, I can give a lot of information from the top of my head and, you know, pretty good stuff, but I found some very good quotes, which I will be very happy to either post on the Student Union or send it directly to Ray, you know, whatever the group wants to do. But what I did is I pulled out quite a bit of references here where the Tibetan tells us the relationship between the sixth ray that's moving out and the seventh ray that's moving in. So I will read it and we can actually talk a little bit about it, and Jocelyn can add some stuff to it as needed. Some of it requires a little bit of elaboration and some of it is very clear on its own. So basically, this is what he tells us, that the sixth ray fostered vision. And where do we see this? We see this in Sagittarius, right? Sagittarius is a sixth ray sign that gives us vision as well. And remember, the sixth ray always looks for the ideal, and the ideal is way up high usually. It's held very, very high. The seventh ray will materialize that which was visioned. Yeah? That's easy. I don't think we need to even elaborate on that one. The sixth ray produced the mystic as its culminating type of aspirant. The seventh ray will develop the magician who works in the field of white magic. One might ask, what do we mean by the magician and what do we mean by white magic? I know that Jocelyn has done a lot of work on this subject, and I'd be happy to talk about it, but why don't you, whatever the expression is, come in, Jocelyn.
Hello. I had to put the cat out. He was okay. Making too much noise. Well, you mentioned about the sixth ray being very mystical, and the God for a sixth ray emphasis is transcendent. The praying hands looking for the external God, the one that is above and beyond, and very, very strong aspiration. Well, now with the seventh ray, there is a realization of the God immanent, the God within. And the white magician is the perfect example of the seventh ray joining the high and the low, because the keynote for the seventh ray is the highest and lowest meet. So here you have the white magician who is able to connect, to unite spirit and matter via the soul. And that is going to be very much emphasized in the coming era of the seventh ray, and we will see much more emphasis on ritual and ceremony to manifest spirit and matter.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see a resurgence of ceremonials and rituals, and perhaps Freemasonry will become much more prevalent and much more out in the open than it is today.
I've always thought of the white magician really as being the soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the white magician is the soul. So the more soul consciousness that we can be influenced by, the more magic we can do in the world. My idea of magic, well, it's more than just my idea. It's how I've been able to articulate it, is that magic is about making the unseen seen. What is the unseen? The unseen is that which lies behind, really. It's that which is esoteric. It's that which is unrevealed. And therefore, the magician can make that seen. Of course, he can make the soul seen in everyday service, in everyday expression, in radiating through the heart, through love. All that is something that the magician can make seen. It's just another take on that.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we're disagreeing here that
right.
the white magician is the soul.
Right.
And the initiate magician is one who can tap into monadic realms and bring down intuition and bring
right.
down the power and the love and the intelligence of the spiritual triad right down to everyday life, the seventh plane, via, of course, the soul, which is the mediator.
Right. Thank you. So moving along, the sixth ray, as part of the evolutionary plan, led to separations, to nationalism, to sectarianism, due to the selective nature of the mind and its tendency to divide and separate. The seventh ray will lead to fusion and synthesis, for its energy is of the type which blends spirit and matter. And that goes right back to what you said, Jocelyn, right?
Mm-hmm.
Goes right back, so I don't think we need to elaborate on that. But you know, this whole idea of separation, nationalism, I mean, we still see that. It's so strong right now. It's so prevalent, all this division everywhere. So we've got a long ways to go still with this. The sixth ray activity led to the formation of bands of disciples working in groups but not in close relation, and subject to internal dissension based on personality reactions. Oh, yes. And I've been in groups where I've seen this. I have been in groups where personality has literally killed the group. Now, the seventh ray will train and send forth groups of initiates working in close unison with the plan and with each other. And that's the key. You know, once you're working from a place of heart and of soul, then you are supporting each other, then you're working together as one in unison, and there isn't this need for ego, personality, rising to the top, being noticed, being important, and so on, which is so separative. Anything you want to say to that, Jocelyn?
No, there's lots of, you know, when you're talking about uniting the highest and the lowest, then you're looking at all the different obstacles that usually come into play to prevent that union. So there are typical dualities that have existed forever, and they are archetypes, and they need to be mediated.
Mm-hmm.
They need to be, so spirit and matter, of course, but you know, we're very familiar with monad and personality being united by the soul. And the in terms of the seventh ray, one big union is the physical and etheric in terms of our being able to perceive the etheric devas. We are told that with the aid of the seventh ray, the etheric planes are going to be receiving special emphasis, and our capability to see etherically will be enhanced. So this will lead to a rapprochement, working together between man and devas much more than we have seen in the past. Mm-hmm. And also that collectively we'll be working on the etheric network of the planet. So at planetary level, the etheric infrastructure of the planet will be modified. Now, this will cause a lot of physical destruction, and we're told that, you know, there will be a reshaping of the physical plane in many ways with the advent of the seventh ray. But the purpose is to destroy all forms so that the new world can be built.
Okay. We're on to letter E here. The sixth ray brought the sense of duality to a humanity which regarded itself as a physical unity. Of this attitude, the academic materialistic psychologist are the exponents. Now, what is the seventh ray going to bring us? It will inaugurate the sense of a higher unity. First, that of the integrated personality for the masses, and secondly, that of a fusion of soul and body for the world aspirants. This is found amongst many psychologists who don't understand and really know the emergence of soul, and therefore the crises, plural, that it can create within the psyche of the individual. And many psychologists do not understand, know how to deal with that. Their interpretation, of course, has very physical plane matter. They refer to a lot of physical plane activity as the result of the crisis people are undergoing, as instead of looking deeper to see what in fact is happening here. Even when an individual becomes an integrated personality, it's a really, really big step. It's far, far more evolved than the masses that are not integrated personalities. We, in our courses in the Moria Federation, we take the integrated personality for granted, because our aim and our goal, of course, is greater soul infusion. But let's not forget that having reached a stage of an integrated personality is a really, really high achievement. And most of humanity is very far off from reaching that level. But that brings within itself a greater opportunity for deep crises, because an integrated personality is now starting to have the soul knocking on its head, on its window, on its door, or whatever. And the personality still wants to stay the authority and the important one, and doesn't want to give up that authority to the soul. So it creates all kinds of difficulty, crises, conscience, etc., etc., that we're all familiar with. But this is an important step that will inaugurate for the psychologists coming into incarnation with the seventh ray energy, much greater understanding of what is required here, or what is happening to an individual because of greater soul and personality infusion. And you can chime in if you want to, Jocelyn.
Well, I can see the role of ceremony and ritual playing part much more obviously than today. We meditate, we build the Antahkarana, we have a lot of spiritual practices that are personal and not in full view and not done as a group. We do have full moon meditations and so on, and they are becoming more and more public. And I see with the seventh ray coming in, that will become much more dispersed throughout the world, not just among certain spiritual groups. That there will be a ceremonial aspect to personality integration and soul personality infusion that will be very process specific. There will be practical tools for creating certain conditions that facilitate union between soul and personality. So I see the seventh ray coming in with process and organization and structure to make it easier, to provide us with tools to be able to do this perhaps more easily than what we have now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also see a ceremonial dissipation of karma. You know, we all know that sixth ray emphasis, especially in the religious field, has created a lot of karma. They have done a lot of harm. And this needs to be redeemed. So the seventh ray will need to come into the picture here and help to dissipate this tremendous sixth ray karma that is still being created today, big time. So there will be ceremonial emphasis for handling the sins of the past. And this is where I see Freemasonry and other very seventh ray, third ray organizations to really materialize these rituals so that they'll be more overt, more popular, and more effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wish, anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it's starting to happen. Ritual, I think, is taking on a much greater emphasis now than it ever did before. They're actually even role-playing and doing ritualistic things now with younger kids in various schools and places of education. Okay, we're going to move along. The sixth ray differentiates that aspect of the universal electrical energy, which we know as modern electricity, produced to serve man's material needs. The seventh ray, period, will familiarize man with that type of electrical phenomena which produce the coordination of all forms.
Eva?
Yes.
Are you reading text on your screen?
Yes.
We can't see it.
Okay, so let's see why we can't see it. Do I want to go back to share my screen? Show my screen. Is that any better?
Your screen seems frozen.
Uh-huh.
With no document on it.
Okay, should I reduce
it? What I would suggest, we've had this problem before with Michael. What we do is we change the presenter briefly from one person to another, and then it picks you back up.
Okay. So, do you do that?
I can do that.
Okay.
Okay. Let me briefly do this.
So you can see, guys, we have technical difficulties, and thank goodness we have someone that knows what they're doing.
I hope.
Mm-hmm.
While we're waiting, how's my sound? Is it better?
Very good. Have you made the presenter show my screen? Let me just go show my screen.
Is that any better?
Much better. Okay. There we go.
Now we can see. Move your mouse around.
And is that still okay?
Yes, it's kind of choppy, but we at least see the movement.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. So I'm going to reread letter F. The sixth ray differentiates that aspect of the universal electrical energy, which we know as modern electricity, produced to serve man's material needs. The seventh ray period will familiarize man with that type of electrical phenomena which produce the coordination of all forms. Now, we see the word forms here, and for those of you who attended the seven ray workshop that, all the different seminars that I offered on that, the word form is very much a seventh ray word. Remember, conform, reform, deform, uniform, those are all prefixes with the word form, and form dealing with the most material of all the planes is a seventh ray word. So the electrical phenomena will produce the coordination of all the forms. So it's not just within the human form. I'm sure that reference is to all forms in all kingdoms as well. And electrical phenomena, does that mean that we will move into the etheric and start to see the electrical phenomena that is normally seen by clairvoyance on the etheric level? You know, I'm not too sure how to exactly interpret that. But, maybe Jocelyn has some thoughts on that.
Not beyond what I said about the electrical, about etheric sight.
Yeah, Yeah, that's how I understand it too. Right now, the electrical phenomena that people, or not the electrical, but the phenomena that many people experience, whether it be in meditation or whatever, are distractions. But maybe later on, when more and more people have that ability, it'll be taken for granted and not be a distraction from moving forward and doing our spiritual work. Okay. Letter G, the sixth ray influence produces the emergence in men's minds of the following knowledges. Knowledge of the physical plane, light, and electricity. Now, you know, that's again, a thing that we all take for granted now. But, you know, if we read the Tibetan's work, and if we go back to his early writings, he said that areas of a lot of electricity and light, when it was originally discovered and then as it became more used, was an indication of how much light, soul light, there actually was on the surface in the world. So the more light that there is, the more it is a symbol of how much light is within us. So we understand it from on a physical plane way, light and electricity. And this has been something that has, you know, through Edison and through other people, they've been working with that quality and understanding light on the physical plane. So it's not a nothing new. It's been going on for hundreds of, well, not hundreds, but, you know, over 100 years now. The second thing, among the esotericists and the spiritualists of the world, knowledge of the existence of the astral light. See, again, this is not new. This is something that the sixth ray has allowed the esotericists to be aware of. And spiritualists are those that work with, they work with what we call occultism, in quotations. They work with Ouija boards. They work with those that have passed on and so on. These are the spiritualists. It's not spiritualism. It's spiritualists. No, it's not spirituality. That's what I want to say. It's not spirituality. It's spiritualism. Okay. I got the two right in my head. And the astral light is a light that allows one to penetrate into a slightly different plane to be able to see forwards and backwards, like the Akashic records. It's not necessarily the our astrality, although it's still on the plane of the astral plane, the astral light. The next thing is an interest in illumination, both physical and mental. Again, that goes right back to what I said right at the beginning. It denotes how much illumination there is in mankind. Illumination shows greater soul. And illumination is of the mind, and we see it on the physical plane. Astrophysics and the newer astronomical discoveries, all of that sixth ray has allowed us to work with. So now, what is the seventh ray going to look like when it comes in? It will change the theories of advanced thinkers of the race into the facts of the future educational systems. Education and the growth of the understanding of illumination in all fields will eventually be regarded as synonymous ideals. Okay, that's basically what I've been saying all along, but there you go. That's what the Tibetan says, that it will definitely be synonymous. The amount of light and illumination that there is has a lot to do with soul. The sixth ray taught the meaning of sacrifice, and of this teaching, the crucifixion was the outstanding emblem to the initiates. Philanthropy was the expression of the same teaching to advance humanity. The nebulous ideal of simply being kind is the same motivation applied to the unthinking masses. Okay, so we got that. That's what the sixth ray brought us. The seventh ray will bring to the consciousness of the coming initiates the concept of group service and sacrifice. So it's group service and group sacrifice. This will inaugurate the age of the divine service. The vision of the giving of the individual in sacrifice and service within the group and to the group ideal will be the goal of the masses of advanced thinkers in the new age. Whilst the rest of humanity, brotherhood will be the keynote of their endeavor. whereas right now brotherhood is the keynote of disciples. These words have a wider connotation of significance than the thinkers of today can know and understand. So here he is giving us a prelude to the idea of working in group, the idea that there will be group initiation, there will be the Aquarian model of what a group ought to look like, and within the group, there is a form of sacrifice. There is service. This is what the group does. And we know that the group is much stronger than the individual. So we're moving away from the individual and much more into the group. The whole idea of an authoritarian leader or teacher is going to alter, and it'll be much more an Aquarian group where everybody has a chance, very much like I think of town meetings. You know, that's already an indication of group involvement, and speaking their minds, and people voicing their thoughts, and seeing if we can work together as a group. And I think that we're seeing the baby steps starting to happen now. Any thoughts, Jocelyn?
Nope, nothing to add.
Okay, so we'll move right down to letter I. The sixth ray promoted the growth of the spirit of individualism. Right. Well, this is basically a continuation of what has just been said. Groups exist, but they are groups of individuals gathered around an individual. The seventh ray will foster the group spirit and the rhythm of the group and the objectives of the group and the ritual working of the group will be the basic phenomena. It goes right back to the idea of the ritual work that you spoke about and the idea of working together in rhythm as a group. You know, Raisin initiation is all about group and the group disciples and the group initiates for any of you that have read that book. And more we understand that group consciousness, which is what soul is, and the more we work towards that, it's no longer about the individual, it's about the group. So that's the future.
Within corporations, we saw that happening, 15 years ago, when it was realized that group work was essential to achieving corporate objectives, right. And that it was no longer the individual maverick who could know it all, do it all, and be responsible for everything. So a lot of the education in the corporate world was focused on teaching people interactive skills and how to work as a group. So we saw tremendous advances in the art of management, the art of committing people to common goals and receiving a commitment that yielded tremendous value to the organization. Mm-hmm. And I'm not part of that world anymore, but it is continuing, and more leadership in organizations equals being able to work within a group, not at the center of a group or at the head of a group.
Mm-hmm. So the sixth ray influence conveyed to men the ability to recognize the historical Christ and to evolve the structure of the Christian faith, colored by a vision of a great son of love, but qualified by an excessive militancy and separativeness based on a narrow idealism. So we all understand that, right? It's the whole, the way the most of the Christian faiths have been. They are separative, and it holds the Christ up as the one and only, and so on. The seventh ray will convey to man the power to recognize the cosmic Christ, that's a little different than the historical Christ, and to produce that future scientific religion of light, which will enable man to fulfill the command of the historical Christ to permit his light to shine forth. Basically, it's to work with the Christ consciousness. And I have very little to say to that. I think it's self-explanatory. And we're just about, I think we're almost done here. The sixth ray produced the great idealistic religions with their vision and their necessary narrowness, a narrowness that is needed to safeguard infant souls. Now, isn't that interesting? That things have happened in such a way that it was, meant to be, or it was needed, or it was a good thing. Now, the seventh ray will release the developed souls from the nursery stage and inaugurate that scientific understanding of the divine purpose, which will foster the coming religious religious synthesis. So we will see a change, from the narrow perspective of most religions to a much wider perspective. Now I think somewhere he talks about the new world order and a new world religion. Now the dotted line is where we're going to stop. The effect of the sixth ray influence has been to foster the separative instincts, dogmatic religion, scientific factual accuracy, schools of thought with their doctrinal barriers and exclusiveness, and the cult of patriotism, which is still so strong, in most countries. The seventh ray will prepare the way for recognition of the wider issues, which will materialize as the new world religion, which will emphasize unity but bar out uniformity. Now, I wonder if anybody's actually thought of the difference between unity and uniformity. It will prepare for that scientific technique which will demonstrate the universal light that every form veils and hides, and for that internationalism which will express itself as the practical brotherhood and as peace and goodwill between the peoples. So, it's a good place to end for the time being. There are more references here that I will send to Ray, or I can put them on the student union. So that's with that. And I just want to go back up to the top, because the next question that was asked was, how, if at all, do you believe karma works out on a group basis? It's a very natural next question, because we're just talking about the group and how the group is the way of the future. So how does karma work out in a group way? I know, Jocelyn, I'll give you a sec on that. I know that there is such a thing as national karma. There is karma that you pick up with the country that you're born into, the race that you are part of. For example, the black race, African American people, they cannot help but carry the karma that is part of their race. Even though this might be their first incarnation as a black person, they can't help but carry that karma. The same holds true for, let's say, the Jewish people. Born into being Jewish, you cannot help but carry the karma of the entire Jewish race and the history that was part of that. It's in you to carry that karma and to I don't know if it's to change, but it's certainly to understand and to be part of that group. So there is that kind of group karma. Jocelyn, what would you like to say to that?
Well, Ray's not here yet, is he?
I don't know if he's here, but maybe he'll just, I know he had to travel and he may want to just take the recording with him. He's not here.
He's asking a very, very good question about a subject that is pretty vast. So we kind of have to guess here what he meant by the question. He's not here to elaborate. So he's asking, do you believe karma works out on a group basis? And in a nutshell, my understanding of this subject is that group karma is constituted of the sum total of individual karma. So the groupings of individual karma into a collective is what can be referred to as group karma. And they both work out in very similar ways, because one fits into the other and the dynamics are very similar, although group karma is greater in scope and greater in power and requires much more elevated or much more advanced people to redeem than individual karma. So Ivar, you're talking about national karma, racial karma. This is the type of karma that is worked on by initiates and masters and beyond, because you need to have the power of the triad in order to dissipate that karma. So the more advanced we are on a spiritual path, the more capable we are to redeem group karma, to redeem this collective karma that has been building ever since we individualized, and that is being redeemed little by little as we develop spiritually. So in trying to answer this question, I think the topics that I'd like to touch on in very briefly is to define karma, individual and group karma, describe the unfoldment of karma, and describe how karma is redeemed both at the individual and group level. So first of all, definition. If we look at the dictionary, karma means action. With greater detail, karma is the cause and consequence of action. And those consequences can be both positive and negative. We often think of karma as being retribution, punishment. However, there is as much positive karma as there is negative karma, DK tells us. So there's a karma of reward as well as a karma of retribution. So the karma of reward is built up by all the positive harmlessness that we generate, the love, the empathy, all the soul qualities that we are able to express in our life, that generates positive karma, generates assets, spiritual assets for us. At the national level, if you have a country that spends, like the United States, they spend so much to help other countries and to feed the poor and to help the disadvantaged, that they are earning a positive karma by being such, by being a nation who takes such care for human rights and making sure that people, disadvantaged people, are helped as much as possible. Now, the United States is another example where we can see negative karma being taken on too at the national level, where some actions that are done by this nation have negative consequences. So you can see that both sides are represented, and if we were to look at the specific groups, other nations, we would see again this generation of positive and negative consequences and the redemption of positive and negative karma that has been going on right since, for humanity, right since we individualized, and it will go on for quite some time yet. So when I said that group karma is the sum total of individual karma, so we're talking here about the karma of a collective, whether we're talking about a family, a community, a race, a nation, and even the planet itself, because there is planetary karma as well. So these various groupings of entities each carries its own load of karma, positive and negative, that has been generated by its members. So the action of individuals generate individual karma while at the same time contributing to the karma of the group to which the individual belongs. And that's instantaneous. So it's a ripple effect. So it's very hard to separate really individual karma and group karma, since the actions of the individual, since we are one, since the group that we belong to is just a higher life that we're part of. So my understanding is that any action that we take affects the group, first of all, the groups in our immediate environments, and over time, the larger groups. So here in Hylozoism, we have a life within a greater life within a greater life. So I see the dynamics of karma being very similar, that you have the individual karma that becomes part of the of a collective karma of a family, of a of a an environment, of an nation, and so on. So it's all for one and one for all, as the Musketeers say. So we're an organism with shared assets and liabilities, and every individual contributes to the creation and dissipation of group karma. And Eva, do you have anything to add at this point
No,
before we...
I thought that was very full and very good. I want to open this up now to the group so that we can have some questions and answers, even though I do have another question on the pituitary gland and the Ajna Center that Victor has sent in, and we will address that, but I think it's time to open this up to the group now and see what kind of questions the group would like to ask. So Victor, hang in there because we will get to your question in a little while. So we need to see hands up. You know, you know how it works, right? The drill is the same. You just put your hand up, and as we see it, we will call on you. Okay, I didn't give you any warning ahead of time, so I hope you have a question here or there. If you don't, I will just move on to answering Victor's question that he sent in. Now, do you guys see the advantage of sending in questions? It certainly gives us an opportunity to do a little research and to give you a much fuller answer than just from the top of our heads, which we can do, but I think it's more advantageous for everybody if we can do a little research. So, I don't see any hands up. I'll give you another couple of minutes. Anybody have any questions? Any question, just go for it, guys. So,
well, I have something to add. If I could just add a little something about karma.
Sure, go ahead.
Something very interesting that I came upon that I'd like to share here is that DK says that initially, when we were infant humanity, there was no individual karma. So I'm sure this is known by many people, but I didn't know that. That we were ignorant and our personality was so out of it and undeveloped that we had no responsibility, therefore we incurred no individual karma. It was simply group karma. So infant humanity as a group received this karma, but the individual was not responsible. And then as we evolved and our personalities became more stabilized, then we could make decisions on our own, and then we saw individual karma take place. Then we started earning good and bad individual karma. And later on, it reverts back to group karma after the third initiation on the way to the fourth, when the dweller on the threshold has been dissolved, conquered by the angel of the presence. Then this great obstacle is not there anymore for the individual initiate. So then he becomes a redeemer of karma for hierarchy, and then is most involved with karma at the national and planetary level. So you see how it was group karma, and then it became individual karma, and after the third initiation, then we revert back to being redeemers, saviors, in terms of group karma.
So I appreciate that because I did not know that either. So that's a good piece. Thank you. Okay, we're going to move on since there are no... Oh, wait a minute. I see Yvonne. Excellent. Unmute Yvonne. Okay. Well,
Hi,
Yvonne.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm about half through reading Lawson's book on karma, but I have some questions since we're talking on karma. How do you dispel karma? You know, the quick course on dispelling karma. I realize that infant humanity, I don't have any, but I've probably accumulated quite a bit over at the class.
You know, it doesn't have to be a tit-for-tat kind of thing, but one of the surest way that the Tibetan always tells us is you live more in soul. You live in soul and you'll work off your karma. The more advanced you become along the path, the more you work off your karma, because that automatically takes in service. That automatically takes in the good that you do for humanity and for others, and that will work off karma. Jocelyn?
Yes, right on. We already know how to do that because DK's teachings about cultivation of quality, about expressing soul quality, about offsetting our vices with virtues, his teachings on meditation, the building of the Antahkarana, and then the service that is the result of soul contact, all of those practices, spiritual practices, are ways to disseminate karma. And I'd like to read a little definition here that is very broad, but it shows, you know, the dynamics of the whole thing. So karma redemption occurs when a stream of life energy is provided with forms of a higher vibration and directed away from that which inhibits evolution of consciousness and the manifestation of the plan. You see? So it's the redemptive process is to uplift the matters so that consciousness has a greater vehicle to express soul quality and then further on to express monadic purpose. So we know already the techniques that are used to redeem karma, and DK said positive harmlessness is the key attitude, the key quality for replacing negative karma with positive karma.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you both.
Any other questions on that?
No, thank you both. It's the harmlessness, I think, is the key word.
Yes, it's the harmlessness, and harmlessness is a big category, because we have, over the years, you know, we have all kinds of references in harmlessness, and the more you read on harmlessness, the more you realize it is all living as a soul. You know, you look at the Dalai Lama; he is the epitome of harmlessness for us right now on our planet. Look how he behaves vis-a-vis China. You know, that's a perfect example. And he has informed and asked all his other Tibetan people to take on his position, to be harmless towards China. That's just one little example. But yes, if you live in harmlessness, harmlessness is soul.
Yeah. And I would add that the whole process of soul personality infusion is karma redemption. Because we are allowing the soul, the solar angel, to redeem the matters of our personality, who are the lunar lives. And they are the ones that carry the ancient karma of the first solar system. And they are the ones that the solar angel is totally committed to redeeming before their mission is accomplished. So the karma redemption is part of a big, big scheme of redeeming the ancient matters from the first solar system.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I do have one question. Now,
yes.
On any question and answering session that you're having, exactly how do we send questions in ahead of time?
Oh, I've included my email address in most of the, you know, when you register, my email address is there. You just send me an email with a question.
Okay, thank you.
No, it's that easy. So okay. Just send me an email, ask a question, and what we do is, depending on how many people are on the panel, is I distribute the question to others, and you know, each one of us gets a chance to think it out, to do a little research, and if there was a lot of questions, we would divide up how we were going to handle it, you know, that kind of thing.
Now I can see the importance of doing that. I'm going to put my hand down now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And I see Victor's hand is up. I'm going to unmute you, Victor. Okay, Victor.
Hi. I have a question. You brought up something, harmlessness. And what about if somebody steals from you, are you, by going after them with a lawsuit, and there's another situation? I've recently been included on a jury duty list. You mm-hmm. go to jury duty, and you're trying to be harmless, and they're asking you to pass judgment on whoever is on trial.
Right. I mean, harmless does not mean not non-action. Harmless does not mean injustice. Harmless does not mean not obeying the laws of the land. Harmlessness, you know, one, it's actually a very good thing to look up the references on harmlessness. But harmlessness comes from a place of heart and a place of soul, and it's how you behave out in the world. Justice is still justice, you know. If someone does wrong, it's their karma, and it's the country's way of dealing with that. Let's put it this way. It's the country's way of, based on our laws, of how to deal with people who do not, you know, follow the laws of the land. It's not about sitting back and being like a doormat and never hurting a fly even or a mosquito. That's not a soul thing. That becomes more of a one's philosophy, you know, if one buys into that kind of thing. But harmlessness is of the heart. And what does your heart tell you? What do you truly, as you ask yourself, is this person telling the truth or is this person lying? And if this person is lying, then you got to meet out the right thing at the time. So yeah, you always go back to what is the right thing here to do? It's always about what is right for the self and what is right for others. All right, it's not lying down and just, not following those kinds of laws. How about on that, Jocelyn? Any comments?
Well, we try to take the high road, you know. So in spiritual terms, what is this high road? And it's very similar to what you're saying, Eva. It's the soul's way, and to look for the soul aspect in any event that is taking place. So when something ugly or harmful needs to be dredged up and highlighted and dealt with, that could be a way to support the forces of evolution. So again, we need a big panorama to understand the implications of a small action. And if we always try to find the soul within the situation, then we can't go wrong because we'll be working from the heart.
You know, even when those that do wrong get meted out their whatever punishment, and I'm using the word loosely here, you know, it provides them an opportunity to learn of their behavior, to learn of what is right and wrong. Not everyone, as we know, is at the same level in their point of evolution. So everything that happens to an individual has with it an opportunity to learn. Likewise, for that person who has to sit in judgment, you are asked to be on a jury for a reason, because that is something that needs to be dealt with and handled. But you have to ask yourself, does this speak like it's the right thing to do here? You know, really question yourself, not to be influenced by other people, let's say fellow jurors, not to be influenced by media, but what is the right thing to do here? Always ask yourself and try to get right into what is the truth for you. I hope that kind of addresses it a little bit.
Just one little more. Saturn is a lord of karma, and Saturn, it wields justice. Saturn governs cycles. Saturn governs evolution. So the lord of karma and the law of karma facilitates evolution, and its justice is always the energy that propels any event towards being contributing to the good and to the evolution of a situation. So if we think of Saturn as the lord of karma, we understand both sides in terms of meeting justice and also the love side that seeks to express the love within any life, mm-hmm. any situation.
Okay, well, I think we're going to move on to the question that was asked about the Ajna Center and the pituitary gland. And there was a quote above this that was from Alan Hopkins' book that really is not that important for what we're going to look at. The question that Victor is asking us is, what is going on between the Ajna, the pituitary gland, and its exit point that would account for a difference in energy based on one's level of spiritual development? And he goes on to say that he's always been interested in the pituitary gland and why some people get a tumor there, and that his aunt, now deceased, had a tumor and so on. So there's a real great interest in this and wanting to understand the ajna and the pituitary body. So a little bit of references here for you, and I can send this on to you too if you'd like, and because there's lots of references that we're not going to deal with all of them today in our session here. So there is a very close relationship between the ajna and the pituitary body, as the latter, being the pituitary body, is the corresponding endocrine gland of the ajna, or the ajna's concretized or physical gland. And down below, as you can see it a little bit on my screen, there is actually a table of the various glands and the centers, and what the glands are the externalization of which center. The light of the personality is expressed through the ajna center, and its externalization is the pituitary body. So when we meditate, many times in our early meditations, one of the things that when I used to, I think it was even Lucis's trust, or was it Michael's early meditations that I did many, many years ago, it was always to bring the vehicles of the personality up into the ajna center, knowing that the ajna center is the distributor, the controller, and the integrator of the entire personality. So the ajna center is all about the personality and all its functions. It's very much like the dial of a radio. I know right now we don't have dials on radios, but think back of a few years ago when we had dials. See, the dials can tune you into various stations and can adjust the static and make it clearer, etc., etc. Well, that's what the personality, that's what the ajna center does with the personality. It controls the personality, it coordinates the personality, and it allows the energy to be distributed through the personality. But the gland for the ajna is the pituitary body. So here's a simple table of chakra and gland correspondences. When, if you're not yet into the year where we're doing the health will deal with all this when you're doing the health course. So with the head, you have the pineal, right? With the ajna, you have the pituitary body. The heart is the external gland is the thymus. The throat is the thyroid. The solar plexus is the pancreas. And the sacral are the gonads, which are your reproductive organs. And the base are your adrenals. Okay, so a little bit more on that. This ajna is a dual chakra. And when we look at depictions of centers, I have, when I do a chakra presentation, I have a lot of visuals, a lot of pictures. Either some people have drawn them or they're from various books and whatever. The ajna center is usually shown as a figure eight, a horizontal figure eight like this. So we see the dualness of it, the two-ness of it, two lobes. At first, it acts as the seat of the personality. Then later, it acts as the instrument of the soul. The ajna center, it's a very interesting thing with the ajna because it is almost like a mirror where it it sends down, let me reverse that. It's like a reflective plate. That's a better way of saying it, a reflective plate. So it can get from up high, from the higher planes, from the triad, from the soul. It can get energy. It can get light. It can get whatever it receives from it. And then that becomes a reflective plate down into the personality, right? So we can reflect that which is received through the ajna into the personality, because after all, it does have a control over the various vehicles of the personality. Here's another little bit on it. It is the expression of the personality. When highly developed as a personality, it is the synthesis of the personality forces, which means the mental, the astral, and the physical vehicles. From a chakric point of view, it means that it controls all the chakras except the crown chakra, which is normally under the control of the soul. Before the soul has full control of its vehicles, expressing themselves through the chakra system, it is the personality force which is dominant, driving them. This occurs at a lower level of development of the spiritual development. As the individual becomes more and more aware of his or her divine nature or the soul and starts to integrate his soul qualities from a psychological point of view, the ajna becomes more and more responsive to the crown energy. So that's what I said. It's like a reflective plate. It can get the energy from up high. It can get it from the head center. It can get it from the soul. The ajna then receives and then distributes, you know, it's almost the reflective plate. I kind of flip it, but it's reflective, so it can just go through it. The ajna then receives and distributes energy from the soul according to the level of evolution of this individual. This process of soul reception, receiving, distributing, gradually develops until at the third initiation, the soul takes full control of the personality. From a chakric point of view, this translates as the ajna becomes fully functioning as the soul receiver and then the distributor. Okay, so the ajna and its exit point. We have to bear in mind that each chakra has both an entry and an exit. Usually the chakras that are along the spine, the energy we are has been explained to us enters in from the back, enters in through the back opening, and exits through the front. So when we say heart, you know, when we emanate from the heart, we see it distributing through the heart and moving outward, forward, whereas we receive it through our back entry point. The question is, what energy or force is it receiving or distributing? It all depends on the level of development of the individual. At a lower point of evolution of the individual, the ajna would receive and distribute personality force. But at the level of the disciple, it would receive some soul energy, and at the initiate level, it would receive and distribute triadal energy. And between these three stages, there is a real cocktail of forces and energies entering and exiting the chakras. So, okay, is that okay? I mean, are we getting clear on that? So, ajna and tumors, since the question was asked about tumors. We have to remember that the soul, which is the second aspect of divinity, is the intermediary between the first aspect, which is will, and the third aspect, which is intelligence, or the form itself, the appearance. All disease is the result of blocked soul energy, or disharmony, or a lack of alignment between the form and the soul. Okay, so disease is blocked energy, or disharmony, or a lack of alignment. Disease will appear whenever a chakra is blocked at any level, whether it's etheric, whether it's astral, or whether it's mental. Okay, now that's a heavy, that's a lot of things there. Okay. In our Aryan race, a tumor or cancer is a disease of a combination of an overstimulation and an excess of retained force by the lower mind. Do we get that? It's retained force or overstimulation. The lower mind controls too much of the astral emotional reactions and feelings. The emotional force is held back by creating a dam. Thus, the chakra closest to the cancer is overstimulated, and the excess force floods into the surrounding bodily tissue. So, you see, we hold a lot of our emotions in our thoughts, in our mind, constantly churning them over and over and over, so that you have the whole kama and manas, the kama-manasic tendency that, you know, when we're upset and when we're thinking about something that constantly circulates and circulates, this can cause what we call stress, what we call overstimulation esoterically, and that can lead to a blockage or a dam in that area. And this is a quote from the Tibetan. Cancer is a disease most definitely related to the centers, and it will be found that the center in the area wherein the cancer exists is overactive, with a consequent increase of energy pouring through the related bodily substance. This energy and the overstimulation of a center can be due not only to the activity of the center and its consequent radiation, but also the suppression imposed by the mind upon any activity of a particular center. This brings about a damming up of energy, and again, we have the creation of too much concentrated energy in any particular area. So the development of the chakras reflects the individual's point of evolution. That's a given, right? Everyone's chakra is at a different point of evolution based on where that person is at. Since every individual is, well, there, I just said that. The chakras will be unevenly developed. So in the case of a tumor in the pituitary gland, it is likely that the ajna couldn't respond to the soul energy due to its lack of development or unfoldment. So here's a whole, how much more do I have here? I just want to go to the dotted line and then I can open it up for questions. The chakras are either unbalanced in their development, arrested in their development or congested, prematurely awakened, unresponsive and unable to measure up to the contact of higher energies. They can be overactive or non-radiatory. In short, the chakras are unable to respond or unfold correctly, and that affects the free flow of energy. So the Tibetan has offered us two more quotes, and then I'll open it up to comments and questions. Today, as there is an uneven development, with some centers unawakened, others overstimulated, and with the centers below the diaphragm overactive, like your solar plexus or your sacral center, you have consequently whole areas of the body where the nadis, which are the tubes or the channels, its reflection is the nervous system, okay, are in an embryonic state. Other areas where they are highly energized, but with their flow arrested because some center along the path of their activity is still unawakened, or if it is awakened, is still non-radiatory. So what did I read here? Areas are either highly energized, but their flow might be arrested because the tubes, the channels, are still not working properly. They're still unawakened or non-radiatory, so they can't really do the work that they're supposed to do. To this constant movement of the centers and to the constant inflow of energies, we can trace much of the discomfort of humanity in its various bodies. It is the inability of the centers to respond or to unfold, which in many cases produces disease and difficulty. So this is what he's basically telling us, that the center can't respond or unfold. It is the unbalanced unfoldment of the centers, their arrested development, and their lack of response which creates problems in other cases. It is their premature unfoldment and their overactivity, which in other cases brings about danger. It is the failure of the physical mechanism to measure up to the inner unfoldment which causes so much trouble. Thus again, you see the complexity of the subject. Okay, so again, we see that has a lot to do with the centers and their unfoldment, their blockage, overstimulation, and not working properly. You know, like in everything else, it's all about soul. Soul will automatically adjust and cause the center to work at its optimum. The more we work on ourselves, on becoming spiritual beings, everything falls into place. Everything goes according as it should, and we don't have to do anything specific to make anything happen. So with so many chakra workshops that talk about, let me balance your energy and let me work on this chakra and that chakra, my advice is always not to mess with the chakras. The chakras know what to do. Now, if it's diseased, sure, there you can work on movement of energy. There's so many wonderful healers around that can work with that. But in normal circumstances, one doesn't need to do anything to their chakras. They know what to do on their own. They are just reflecting where we're at in our point of evolution. So, any comments, any questions? This is the time, guys. We've got a good 20 minutes here. We have no more prepared questions and answers for you. This is open to all of you to ask questions, comment on what you've heard thus far, and so on. So we're going to see your hands going up, right? Hands go up. So let me ask, Victor, did this address your question?
Yes.
Okay. Does that help you understand the whole relationship between the pituitary gland and the ajna, and why someone can end up with tumors there?
Yes, that makes it clear.
Okay.
I would like you to elaborate more on about injustice again. I would like for you to carry that on, if you would.
Injustice?
If somebody steals from you, one position, you know, it's just, in my mind, it's somebody doing something, maybe as a test to me, to see how I'm going to react to it. But if they harm you financially or otherwise, to me, it's like, let them go. And then there's another part of me that says, yeah, but it's financially, they robbed me or they stole from me. So,
well, not knowing the situation, it's hard to comment how one should be, but always look within oneself to see what kind of a charge you have with all of that. Is there a charge? If there's a charge, it's usually an emotional thing. But if the emotions are out of the way, and then you ask yourself, what is the right thing to do here? Then you might be able to get a sense of the right next step in all of this. If it's unimportant, then you don't have a charge. If you want to say, just let the person go because it's no big deal, you don't have a charge to it. And maybe that is the way to do it for you. But if it's a really unjust thing that this person has done, then there are consequences. And whether it's suing someone, whether it's calling the police, whatever there is a justice system, and the justice system is there for a reason. It does take a toll on the person pursuing the justice system, without a doubt. Then you have to ask yourself, is it worth it? I know many, many people don't go about suing because it's not worth it, because it does take a toll emotionally and physically and mentally. Bottom line is, again, it's got to come from the heart. What is the right thing to do in this circumstance? Was it an accident? Was the person acting out of a place of evil? Was he acting out of a place of ignorance, and so on?
Well, I can add here that there is such a thing as divine justice, and it's called the law of karma. And this person who has done harm has incurred karma, and karma is a boomerang. There will be retribution from which the person will grow. It may not be next week, it may not be this year, or even in this life. However, this person will have to redeem the karma that he or she has caused, because whoever generates it must dissipate it. So the high road is whatever feels what the soul would do. And as Eva said, you know, what's the heart position here? Because karma will take care of justice in terms of what this individual has done.
That's right. It's something, you know, the average person does not understand. You know, I've taught my grandkids, and my daughter has taught the kids, what goes around comes around. It's that simple. You don't have to do anything. Many times it'll happen on its own. What goes around comes around. So justice will, from a karmic perspective, will find its way. And it may not be in my lifetime or your lifetime, but that's why people, I don't know, suffer. And that's why people have things, and then we say how lucky they are. It's all based on karma to some degree, you know? So I don't know if that addresses your question, but right now my mind can't think of other things to say.
I have one other question added to that. Do I create any negative karma by not taking action?
Sometimes, yes. You know, it depends. It depends on the deed. See, it's not. There's nothing black and white here. There's nothing that's cut and dry, saying, well, if I don't do this, then I, you know, it doesn't work like that. I remember many years ago when I used to do a lot of Eastern philosophy, and I used to read the books. There was a very interesting story about an Indian person. You know that in India, their whole idea of karma is really reflected in their life, and then they have the whole sects and so on. It's all reflected in karma. So this Indian person was walking along the river, and he saw someone drowning, and he asked himself, well, what do I do here? Do I go in and save that person? But what is the right thing to do here? If I save the person, am I intruding on this person's karma and this person's destiny if I go in and save him? Or do I mind my own business and just follow the path that I'm on? And this became a whole discussion in this book as to which path to follow. Am I going to be doing bad karma to myself if I go in and save this person who should be drowning because that's what he's meant to do? I'm just here by accident, and so on. So, you know, it causes one to really think, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing bad karma? Am I doing good karma? I don't think we need to think about this, really. I think if we start thinking about it, we end up like the people in India. You know, the lower sect will not, or the higher sect will not go with the lower sect because that's the wrong thing to do, because their destiny is meant to stay within their caste, and so on. The whole caste system is based on karma and based on the state that you are born into, which is then your destiny, and then you can't change your destiny. Whereas the spiritual approach is you do what is the right thing to be done at the time. What is, again, of the heart? Are you going to let someone drown? I mean, aren't we out here to help one another, to be compassionate, to be of service? You don't let someone drown. If they're going to drown, they're going to do it on their own when you're not around. If you're around, you're there for a reason, and then and it's your position to help. Jocelyn, I saw a smile on your face.
Yeah, that's the key, I think.
You got to get closer to the mic. I cannot hear you.
You wouldn't be there if you weren't meant to do something that's positive.
That's right. That's right. So justice, I mean, we're not the lords of karma. We do not mete out the justice. The justice takes care of itself. But we always have to ask ourselves, are we in alignment with what is right? You know, that what is my motive here? Is my motive vengeance? Is my motive to get this person to pay back what he or she has done to me? Or is my motive here what is justice? And you know, the mind can play tricks on yourself. It can do a lot of damage by saying, yeah, that's the person deserves that, and so on. So again, I there's no clear cut answer here. I'm just thinking that I might see if I can find a compilation of harmlessness and send it to you. It'll be a lot of reading, but you can read that. Okay. Okay, Victor. So Vera, I have you unmuted. Hi, Vera.
Yeah. Hello, Eva. Hello, Jocelyn. Yes, I emailed my question yesterday, but never mind.
I'm sorry, but I didn't receive any. Somewhere along the way there was a glitch.
Okay, sometimes I come across with statement that our body, being say mental or astral, can change, transition from one ray to another during incarnation. And I don't know if I understood it right, but if that is correct, then what would be the purpose, and mainly what would be the mechanics of that process? How can, say, mental body can change during incarnation from one ray to another?
In reading the Tibetan's letters to his disciples, you know, he had 24 disciples, there were, I think, just two places where he told the disciple that he or she was in transition, moving from a sixth ray soul to a second ray soul. I haven't come across him telling anybody that they were in transition and moving on their lower vehicles. So I would have to see a reference to that to see it in context and to understand what is being said there, if it is the Tibetan that's saying that. My understanding is that your three vehicles, the substance of your three vehicles is as a result of what has been stored in the permanent atoms. And before incarnation, these permanent atoms attract to themselves matter of the same rate of vibration as what has been stored in those permanent atoms. Then the soul designs pretty well the purpose of the life and what it is that the individual, you, has to work on in a given incarnation, thereby creating or offering certain qualities that are ray qualities to the vehicles, because this is all part of the mosaic that you have in a given incarnation to work on your purpose, to learn how to deal with those ray qualities, to learn how to move through life with them. So it's not haphazard. There definitely is a plan. Why it would change, I don't really know, and I don't understand that. So I would have to see a reference, is all I can say. If you can come across the reference and send it to me, I would gladly investigate that and get back to you on that.
Yes, thank you for that, because that makes sense. My understanding was the same, that it's not just haphazard, that it just cannot be switched from overnight. And so maybe it was a reference to the soul transitioning, and I took it as the lower body. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right, we have Constance next. Let me unmute you, Constance. You do have your hand up. Yes, hi, Constance. Hello? Are you with us, Constance? Okay, that isn't working. So let me see if there's anybody else. Okay, there's Ani. Let me unmute Ani. Hello, Ani.
Hello there. Thank you so much for the program. I do have a question. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Okay. A little faint, but I can hear you.
Okay, well, let me move my mic up a little bit.
I'm much
also
better.
Battling. I have a cat here that's trying to attack the wires. So
well, Jocelyn just went yelling through that at the beginning.
In fact, he just unplugged me, but it's still connected. Oh, well, I'll let it go. I'm sorry. You mentioned earlier, and I hope I understood you correctly, that when you were early on in your training, that Michael gave you some exercises or practices to help you develop. Is it possible to get something like that? Or is it somewhere in one of the Bailey books?
You must be referring to meditations that I've talked about. I took with Michael the MSE course way back in 1988, 89. 90, something like that. So they were part of the meditations way back then. Trying to think, what was that in reference to? To the personality and the Ajna Center. So
right.
I don't have anything that was of Michael's. But when I used to, when I had a center and I used to give people a lot of homework to do in the classes, I have some very simple meditations that probably include that. I can maybe see what I've got in my library of meditations and see what would be useful and what would kind of take that in and send it off to you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and that would...
Okay, I really appreciate that.
Those are very simple meditations that I'm sure at this point you would find them a little elementary. Because that basically was teaching people how to, you know, relax the physical vehicle, to relax the emotional, and then to then later on bring it all up to the Ajna Center. You know, it's that kind of simplicity. So I think it would be really elementary for you. But if you still want it, I'll do that.
Yeah, I'm familiar with relaxing the levels and so forth, because we do that in the Raja meditation.
Exactly.
As far as bringing it up to the Ajna Center,
That's just another thing. It's just then you take all the energy from the three vehicles, you bring it up to the ajna, and then you know that that is the coordinated integrated personality. Then from there, you move to wherever you visualize or imagine your soul to be. And it can be as a sphere of light above the head. It can be in the heart. It doesn't matter. But that would be the step then following the personality. It's really, really very simple.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Well, thank you. I'm going to go back to my cat.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I have BL here. Hi, BL.
Hi, Eva. Hi, Jocelyn. Hi, everybody. I just wanted to mention that, you know, there are, as Ani mentioned, there are the Raja Yoga meditations, and the first 2 years in the Great Quest, which is, she's just finishing the first year right now, they do, in fact, go through some of those. The second year will continue with that, it goes through, you know, the meditation on harmlessness. It goes through all of the commandments, all of the rules, so you get your opportunity to meditate for a month on all of those.
Right.
And then, of course, when you get into the Quest Universal, the meditations become a little more complex, and they are designed to match the study material all the way through the 7-year program. So
right.
I just wanted to bring that up.
Right. So, you know, as I said, it would, if I sent her something, it would be very, very elementary. It's what I would offer to absolute beginners who haven't got really a clue on how to meditate. It's just to teach them how to go through each vehicle. Most people don't think of themselves as having even vehicles or know that they have vehicles. Most people don't understand the esoteric definition of what a personality is. So it's that kind of basic meditation. But thank you very much, BL. So anybody else? Mary Bell. Okay, let me unmute you. And little by little, I'm unmuting everybody, and you're staying unmuted because I haven't muted you back up. So Mary Bell, hi.
Hi, Eva. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Well, I was just listening to the conversation with BL and the other member about Raja meditation, and it sounds like they're going through some training, and I'm very much interested in learning Raja meditation. So is there anything out there that people can send me a link to?
That, you know, I would ask Kay.
Okay,
yeah, I would ask Kay. To ask, you know, ask her how you could have a link to that, just to take a look at the meditations. It's not my domain, you know. It's part of the administration's department.
Right.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Eva. I so much enjoyed this webinar, and every time I hear you, I learn something new.
Oh, that's good. It's meant to be like that. So that's a good thing.
Well, thank you very much, Eva.
You're very welcome. So, guys in the back there, I don't know how to remove all these hands up. So, I don't know whose hand.
Oops.
I don't know whose hand is up.
I just put mine down.
And so, Victor, I see your hand up. Is it really up, or is this still from before?
It's up.
It's up. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have two questions. One is about writing essays, and that we're going in the dark half of the year. Are we first-year students supposed to do an essay? And also my second question is about the astrology. The soul, if it's on a one of the crosses, the mutable cross, is that soul not very advanced? When it is in the next life, does it go from mutable to fix, and then to, is it a progression?
Okay, you're asking really good questions. This area creates tremendous confusion for all people that are learning astrology. The fact that you as an individual have, what are you calling your soul? Are you calling your soul your ascendant? Is that your soul?
Right.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
Okay, that is not necessarily...
It's mutable.
Okay, that's not necessarily your ascendant. It is the method by which I'm sorry, that's not necessarily your soul. It is the method by which you as a soul will work out your purpose in this incarnation. It doesn't mean that this is your soul. That's the first thing. The second thing, whatever cross one finds their ascendant or their sun sign on has nothing to do with your point of evolution, has nothing to do with that. There is, however, now going back to the crosses, there is, however, a progression that the soul goes through as it is moving along in from one incarnation to the other. It is true that in the early stages, the soul, now that doesn't mean that what your, you know, whatever shows up on your chart, the soul moves through the mutable cross, and all the signs go through all the signs, whether they are on the mutable or not on the mutable, the soul is on the mutable. So it learns in a different way, and it moves backwards along the zodiac. It moves from, it moves clockwise, okay? It moves clockwise. So it moves backwards. But that incarnation can be with the ascendant on the cardinal cross, with the ascendant on the fixed cross. It doesn't matter where the ascendant or the sun sign is on. The progression of the soul is along the mutable cross in terms of what it has to learn. After I'm hearing a lot of noise because I haven't muted you guys, so I'm hearing a lot of computer noise in the background. So I don't know what to tell you to do, but shh. Okay. So I don't know if that was clear or not, or if I jumbled what I had to say, but there is a point where one considers themselves able to reverse the direction. You'll be learning a lot about this once you get into much more astrology. You reverse the direction. The soul reverses the direction. It reorients itself. That's a key word. It reorients itself, and it starts to go then in an anti-clockwise direction. Then the soul is on the fixed cross. But again, and that's the cross that most aspirants and disciples who have reoriented themselves find themselves on, the fixed cross. This is the cross of the new group of world servers. This is the cross that is the cross of consciousness. And you can be there for a long time until after the third initiation, whereby, between the third and fourth, whereby the soul will move on to the cardinal cross, still on the reversed wheel.
How can you tell where the soul is if the ascendant is not necessarily...
That has nothing to do with it. It had nothing to do with it. It has to do with point of evolution. The crosses deal with point of evolution. The ascendant is just your ascendant in this incarnation, and it'll change in the next incarnation. So to give you a picture is the rays are inherent. That is what you are born with, right? The rays. The astrology influences you from the outside. And the astrology changes with each incarnation. The rays do not all change in each incarnation. Some of them could, but chances are that the soul stays the same. Chances are that the personality goes through a few lifetimes of staying the same until you learn how to wield that. Then it might change. So one is what you are born with, and the other one is the outside influence. But together, we need to know what it is so that we have a better picture of who we are. So, Jocelyn, would you like to add anything to all of this?
Yeah, it is a complex subject, and you've done a good job answering that. I would just say that it is the personality that evolves. It is the personality that needs to better itself. So the position on the path is determined by the vibrational resonance between the personality and the soul, how much the same they are, how much the personality can express soul in the daily life. So the soul itself is a high initiate. It's the personality that's in terms of facilitating the expression in the lower worlds. So the point of is the point of evolution of the personality in terms of its being able to express soul in the lower planes.
Thank you for that clarification there. Okay, I'm looking at the time, and I think our time is up, and there's still a lot of hands there, so I don't know if they're fresh hands or old hands, but I think we're going to have to go.
Answer the one on writing essays.
Oh, writing essays. For the very first year, I think you will get that very shortly, and it will be to read a book, and I think it is Initiation Human and Solar, and then you need to pray it in your own words. I don't remember exactly what the instructions on that are.
Eva?
But you, yes?
Eva?
Yes.
Excuse me. The instructions for that can be found for the Great Quest Level 1. It's Section 7. It'll give you the guide to writing the paper, and it gives you the instructions on who you have to do the paper on. I think it's actually this year, I think it's an astrological profile on a famous person.
Uh-huh. So it's changed from last year.
No, this is for Great Quest Level 1. What you're talking about, I think, is for the preparing for Great Quest.
Oh, could be.
So each level has a different paper that would be required. But they're listed in each section of the campus. So
okay.
Go to your homeroom and look at about Section 6 or 7, the one that begins the dark half of the year, and it will give you instructions on the paper.
Excellent, BL. Thank you.
Excuse me. Number 7 is still locked on the last time I looked at it.
Oh, it's locked right. For you.
Because we're still doing 6. But 7 should just have been opened. Let me go to Leonie and have her unlock it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So thank you, everybody, for attending. And this has been recorded, and you'll have it available in a few days. And you know, it's there. So, again, thank you all. Yvonne, I see your hand.
I just wanted to say goodbye.
Thank you, Yvonne, and bye-bye to you. Bye-bye to everybody. Okay. You know what? I'm going to unmute everybody so we can all say goodbye to one another. Can you all see each other on this thing? Yeah, you can all see the names. I'm going to unmute you all.
Right.
So,
okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, so bye-bye, everybody, and thank you all for attending. And please, when we do this again, send in your questions.
Thank you, Eva.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.